is BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore. In this episode, we're taking a look at ambulatory surgery centers, how they've evolved, policy changes, process for integrating workflows, and some key design differences. My guests in this episode are Craig Pichetti and Terry Joy. Both are FGI GERC 2026 committee members for the forthcoming new 2026 edition. Both are members of subcommittees within the outpatient and hospital groups relating to procedural workflows, infection prevention, and emergency preparedness for Facility Guidelines Institute. Craig Pichetti is a principal and healthcare architect with ACA and EDAC certifications and instructs the ACA certification prep course. He graduated from Texas A&M with a Bachelor of Environmental Design. Craig is also the Austin Studio Director. Craig has been actively involved in the design of ambulatory surgery centers for almost 30 years and has over 100 ASC projects nationally, has worked with several nationally known surgery center developers and operators. Terry Joy is the Director of Ops Planning at BSA and has been with the firm for 7 years. A graduate of Indiana State University, Terry has certifications in EDA, Emergency Nursing and Trauma Nursing. Those are CN and TCRN certifications. And she has spent over 33 years as a registered nurse. 26 of those years have been in the clinical operations and leadership roles with Eskenazi Health and Union Hospital. At Eskenazi, Terry was the Director of Trauma Services, Perioperative Services, Orthopedic Services, and Clinical Education. She has served as an education board member for the Nursing Institute for Healthcare Design for 3 years, and member of the HCD and PDC Abstract Review Committees over the last 3 years. Terry is a member of subcommittees within the Hospital Group for Facility Guidelines Institute.
Welcome back to the show, Craig and Terry. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
It's always nice to talk to both of you. You're both such a wealth of knowledge on a variety of topics. But today I wanted to bring you both on to talk about ambulatory surgery centers, something I know you've both worked together on. So let's jump in here. Let's first define for our audience, what is an ambulatory surgery center?
All right. So I'll jump in and just give a brief overview. An ambulatory surgery center, a lot of people also call it an ASC. So that's like the shortened acronym.
Yep.
It's an outpatient center, and it's a healthcare facility where surgical procedures are completed, and some other procedures that aren't quite as invasive are also completed there. And it's meant to be an outpatient, so you come in, you have your procedure, then you're discharged home. What we've seen from a market perspective is that these facilities can be owned by a hospital, can be a joint venture with a hospital and a company, or just run by a company, can also be physician owned as well.
Yeah, great. And I'll just tag on to that. You know, I love doing these centers and just really have appreciated working with Terry on these. Yeah, these centers just are very highly focused. You know, they're purpose driven. And from a design standpoint, they're going to be focusing on a streamlined operation and a heightened patient experience. Unlike hospitals, these are going to be focused on kind of the lower risk type patient population, people with less comorbidities, to where they can get in there, get their procedure done, and get out of there. These facilities are designed for enhanced efficiency and patient experience enhancements. And every area of the floor plan, it's got to flow right. It's got to function and be flexible. And it's really usually pretty streamlined in terms of the way that you design and have a lot of cross-utilization of spaces to minimize the footprint. Just a couple things. There is a 21% growth projected in the next decade in this market. So it's not going away. It's a continuing growing market. There are 11,500 licensed ASCs in the U.S., and about 6,300 of those are Medicare-certified facilities.
Where are some of the hot zones for those, the certified ASCs?
So actually, some of the areas that are really leading in are Texas, actually, where I'm at.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And then we've got Florida, and we've got California as the top three there.
That seems to track, too, with some of the movement of the population, right?
That is correct. Yes.
So, Craig, how have ASCs, I'm going to use the acronym since TJ threw it out, it'll help me from having to pronounce ambulatory the entire time.
Yeah.
How have ASCs evolved in recent years, Craig?
Well, so the interesting thing is, I guess I've been doing these since the kind of mid-90s, and they certainly have evolved in complexity. You started out doing smaller, more routine, high-volume procedures, and now it's moved into a much more complex world of capitalizing on technology and robotics and that sort of thing. And then all the different pieces that have slowly introduced themselves to the actual setting through the approval of CMS, which I'll get into here in a little bit. One factoid about ASCs is you currently have about a 1/3, 2/3 split between single specialties being about 1/3 of the market and multi-specialty centers being about 2/3. So the leaders in the single specialties are the ophthalmology, eyes, cataracts, and of course the GI world with colonoscopies and endoscopies.
One thing I'll add is with the amount of specialties that are starting to be allowed to be done in this environment, there's a lot of pre-op care that's completed before a patient gets there, so they know what to expect, so that it kind of expedites that patient management. Mm. You really want the patient to be optimized and healthy when they come in, because that decreases the amount of complications or the inability to go home that day. So I think that thinking about orthopedics, thinking about some of the additional cases and equipment that also are being brought into this space now, mm-hmm. really that pre-op and kind of pre-care and teaching becomes very important so that their stay becomes efficient.
I'll add that orthopedics is still the most profitable. You have your routine high volume stuff like the endoscopies, which are less profitable, but because you get so much routine high volume procedures, the centers are just booming, and there's still a lot of them. Okay. And the complexity in some of these centers now with total joint, the spine, and even neuro in the surgery center environment.
Interesting. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the recent healthcare policy changes and what the impact has been on ASC development.
There's been some good developments in terms of allowing centers to really expand their list of covered ASC procedures to diversify and also to benefit patients in a better setting. So basically 32 new approved procedures have come out in 2025 as of July, according to Becker's ASC.
Okay.
And actually 33 additional were reclassified. They were once packaged procedures or non-payable procedures, and they've been reclassified. So if you just do the math on those, I mean, you get a new entry of a lot of things that can actually help diversify case type and also mm-hmm. make your business the right mix of specialties and the right profitability kind of targets for your centers. It is interesting to note that ASCs really, from my estimates, get about 50% to 60% less of the hospital rate, what you'd get from CMS in a hospital. But because the profitability is high and the efficiency and the volumes in the surgery center, even with a reduced reimbursable pay model, it's actually still a profitable endeavor. One additional thing I might just mention here that's interesting, because I think everyone hears about reducing reimbursements always going down for particularly for like physician practices and that sort of thing. Not that this is a huge number, but 2.9% payment increase from CMS in 2025. So they did get a payment increase of 2.9%.
So I think all of that is really important. And kind of what I talked about up front, when you're trying to prepare for surgery with your insurance company or if you're a Medicare patient, then understanding what's allowed to be done in an ASC, because it's a little bit regulated by the government, even if you don't have Medicare. That's kind of the benchmark that insurance companies use that say these are the inpatient, it's called an inpatient only list. They don't allow those procedures to be done. But I will say one thing that helps with the offset of the lower reimbursement. So it's less expensive for the patient. It's less profit for a hospital system. However, if it is an efficiently run program and center, there are less resources, there's less waste. It's a very lean model, and it allows for there to be less facility fee, kind of less overhead to run those departments when you're trying to offset costs of a hospital setting. Doing more with less, being as safe, having the same outcomes, really having an efficient and lean environment is what allows these to be profitable.
Well, I've heard of legendary stories. I'm going to pivot here, of the two of you driving together and having these long conversations. So I want to ask, how do your different backgrounds complement each other and blend so well on some of these ASC projects? Because I know you guys work together a lot.
That's a great question. We spent many hours on the road and hitting the local honky-tonks in Texas.
Yes.
In terms of how we've complemented each other, it's been a completely refreshing experience working with Terry over the past few years. And she's really had me fixate on those small details. Lean flows of healthcare and exactly what that means and how that impacts operations and planning, how you plan for it. And the bottlenecks that are created, the inefficiencies that are created, the compromise to patient and family experience, and the ultimate just general outcome. She made me realize it's not just about patient movement. Oh, you know, that's very important, obviously. There's a lot of other intertwined pieces, the information, supplies, specimens, equipment, and all that sort of thing that really, in many cases, does not want to overlap the patient experience. So as we start talking about little design challenges and maybe some design solutions, what we can think about maybe how, as you get more compact, these things get more challenging in terms of managing the lean flows and where they shouldn't overlap, but they do. Yeah, it's just been great at thinking, that clinical thinking that she's introduced to the working and planning team on the design side. It's just been amazing.
Terry? Do you have any compliments to pay back to Craig?
I do. I feel like I need to pay him a lot of compliments. I think I started working with Craig as a principal closer, probably 3 to 4 years ago. And when we would drive, that would be our focus time because he's very busy. He leads the Austin office in a wonderful way, but his time is precious. So flying into Austin, getting in a car and having 2 focused hours with him really helped me understand what the goals were of the project. I think the biggest thing that Craig helps me do, and I think it makes me a better planner, is understanding some of that big picture thinking for the client. He has immense experience in ASCs and out in the outpatient world. He's kind of the go-to person for Texas Code. I've learned so much about Texas Code from him, which is a little bit different than FGI requirements. And those are kind of some of the building codes and some of the design guidelines we use. But he also helps me understand kind of what the endpoint is. And I think us kind of having big picture and then that detailed work plan and kind of the detailed workflow has helped us really turn out some good environments, I think, for patients and for provider.
You both mentioned workflow there a couple of different times in terms of what you've learned and working with each other. So what is the process for integrating clinical workflow needs with architectural design?
I think that just having that team in the room listening to each other is step one, because they may have a very focused goal on the design, and then just trying to do some layered thinking with design, MEP, and operational planning and space planning becomes very important, because there's always some part of the patient workflow that is competing. We have a budget. We have to stay on track. Some of the things that I'll do with the team is really just do a scenario or a patient journey. I think some of the team in Texas is really using this as well to think about, okay, if I come in for surgery, what's my step? Well, I'm going to drive on the campus. I need to park. I need to figure out how to get in. And really going through those steps and mapping that out to make sure that we all understand the movement in the design. And I think those are the things that I usually will start off with. Sometimes we will also talk about, like Craig said, we want there to be an onstage piece where the patient's interacting, but we also want there to be a safe offstage piece for providers to collaborate and also supplies and medications and other things that are kind of behind the scenes that you don't necessarily want everyone to see. So how do we really separate those flows if that's possible? So we do that with scenario planning, and just I like to be in the room to listen to what the designers and architects are planning. That really helps me try to tailor what they might need from me so that we understand the patient journey.
She nailed it pretty well on the journey mapping and how we understand the full journey and how the individual clinical pieces weave in with all of the various administrative component and also the patient and family interacting with the facility. I think that we also have some tools we've implemented, and we've done some simulation modeling using some of our technology tools that have allowed us to kind of test some operational models, staffing models, how the PACU might turn around, just the whole patient journey, and if there's any backups in the OR itself, or the procedure suite, or in the in pre or post-op. Some of these simulation models can actually identify potential modifications to the floor plan or yeah. any or planning. And actually, in some cases, it's an operational adjustment. Sometimes it's staffing. I know, TJ, you've done a lot more simulation modeling than me, and you've seen the benefits. But usually you can run the data and the feedback loop informs the plan, and then you're able yeah. to understand mm-hmm. how you might tweak things a little bit.
I do. I think it also identifies if it's an operational model, or it can identify if it's a building that's not enough space or it's not staffed correctly. So it does help us kind of tease out what the real issue is before making a building modification. Is it that we also need to look at that operational model that the client is using is not necessarily the benchmark that we're using. So it does help us have some data and some talking points with the client and with the team to really optimize that environment.
So what are some of the key differences then between hospital OR design and an AF design?
So it's funny because I'm in Texas. So of course, Texas is a little different in both the outpatient and the hospital inpatient side. TJ and I have the involvement in the HGRC with FGI. And we've got the outpatient. And we've also got the hospital represented. So we always have this in mind when we think about things. And just because you're told you can do a 240 square foot OR, whether that's the right thing or not. In the state of Texas, you can do a OR that's 240 square feet at the inch. That's an entry level OR, and that's clear square footage. So, gotcha. You introduce other things on the floor. Obviously, the room needs to be bigger. By comparison, FGI entry level is like 255, and that would be if you're not doing anesthesia, and then it starts to get larger. 270 is kind of the entry level with anesthesia, and then you get up to 400 square feet, which is actually the starting point for the hospital. Okay. So I guess the first thing to reinforce there is the fact that ASCs tend to be a little bit more compact in design, lean in program. They're more efficient to build because they're smaller than a hospital surgical department. There's many times our rooms are smaller. So the 400 square foot, OR is probably on the increase as additional technologies get introduced and more procedures get more complex. It's just that room is too small. So though you might be able to do a 240 square foot room in Texas, you will quickly realize it'll be very limiting for you. But you also have the world of what you used to be doing in the hospital, now in the surgery center. And so you are looking at maybe a 600 plus OR footprint because of the procedures that are now being done. So is it you get more towards the higher acuity patients in this settings, the ORs are definitely going to get larger. But generally speaking, a lot of ASCs, the ORs aren't as complex. In general, the way they're equipped and laid out, many times you don't have as many anesthesia booms, equipment booms, unless maybe you're in a spine or an orthopedic situation where you're trying to manage a lot of pieces and you have a lot of dynamics in the room. Many times you'll see a more limited way the room is equipped. You will sometimes see AV integration from Stryker or Steris within the room. Just a variety of things, but many times it's less complicated in the way it's equipped.
I was thinking in a hospital, you really have to be prepared to handle, depending upon what kind of hospital, if it's a stroke center, if it's a trauma center, if it's a heart center, you do have some unpredictability in that OR setting because you have to be able to take somebody from an ER ICU directly into the OR within like a 10-minute period. That's not typically occurring in an ASC. It's very planned. It's very scheduled. Not that hospitals aren't scheduled, but you don't have that additional layer of the unknown because these patients are typically screened. So some of these critical adjacencies and services, I think, Craig, when you were talking about like a simpler room setup, really in an outpatient setting, if a patient has a bad outcome or decompensates, they are going to be transferred to a hospital. So when we build an ASC, we look at if a patient had an event in the OR, how do we get them into an ambulance and get them out? Versus in a hospital, if they had an event in the OR, it would be, how would we get them to CAT scan? How would we get them to radiology? How would we get them to IR? So it's a little bit different of a layout. And that's when those patient scenarios, I think, come into play as well. The only thing I will add is as the CMS list changes and says, hey, total knees, spine cases, those are very instrument set heavy cases. And that's why the room needs to be bigger. So if you're having a hand procedure or an elbow procedure, upper extremity, it could be 2 to 3 surgical pans of instruments. If you're having a spine procedure, you could be upwards of 10 to 15 pans plus a microscope plus. So really understanding, I think, what their goals are is something that I think, Craig, you do a really nice job of with the client to understand the case mix.
Since I am so far not in this realm, I am fascinated every time I talk with you guys about workflow, this spatial situation, like how, you know, I'm just a user of these spaces, not very frequently, thankfully, but still you go in and you just don't realize how much thinking has gone into how everything's laid out. So what are some of the critical spatial relationships and effective ASC layouts?
I'll just highlight some of the main drivers in terms of the way you lay things out, especially from a regulatory standpoint. A lot of these things, if you don't have them right, you will not get your state approval, your license. So now this is where people get in trouble sometimes, right? They design their first ASC. And they're used to doing doctor's offices. And then all of a sudden you read the regs and there's a lot of stuff in there that's, if you haven't done it enough, you don't understand exactly the intent. FTI actually is really great, obviously, at help for people that are first timers because they've, over time, each cycle, they iterate and they add additional information to remove any ambiguities over something that's maybe been questioned or even AHJs have questioned. So that's an interesting piece in itself. So the surgical suite and the connection to prep and PACU, obviously a very critical component, how that all works together, the connections. There's a lot of direct connections that have to happen. There's a lot of very, the red lines that occur that you have to make sure that you manage patient flow, family flow, and staff flow across that. You also have clean and soil flows in and out of the suites and the various patient care areas. You've got supplies going in and out. You've got equipment storage you have to manage. You have stab zones that have to be planned accordingly, locker rooms and respite areas removed from the patient care area. In Texas, in particular, your locker room flow has to be very from the unrestricted to the semi-restricted area in terms of flow for downing and infection control reasons. And then this idea of developing a flexible kind of platform that can adapt to a variety of needs, especially if you're multi-specialty with a variety of patient mix. And I like the idea of standardizing patient care stations as much as possible, where you can flex based on the time of day, where you might have more patients recovering. That the idea of having more of a universal style room tends to be kind of in terms of the relationship, and then kind of the centralized nurse stations, and you might have to have several, depending on how large your patient care station suite is. Many times you'll see all those clustered together in one area with common support down the middle.
Let me just define a couple of things that you said. So red line is brought up a lot. Red line means if you pass that line, you have to have on scrubs. The AORN, which is the Operating Room Nurses Association that sets some of the infection prevention parameters, the OR platform is really about infection prevention, because you are introducing instruments into somebody's body, typically into a cavity, or doing what we, is a sensitive term, Craig, invasive procedures, like you're actually entering the body with something. Sure. So you could introduce an infection. All the stuff that Craig talked about with passive travel and workflow are very regulated in this environment. You can't go from dirty to clean. You can't. And so you really have to think about, where do your supplies come in? Where does the patient come in? Where does the physician scrub? And really, you have to look at that multiple times as you're building these areas. I do think that airflow and air exchange is important in these areas. So our MEP colleagues do participate with us, because there are very specific airflow requirements and filtration requirements for infection prevention. I also think that Craig's point about recovery of these patients, when we say phase one recovery, that means that at some point you've had an artificial airway in your mouth or throat, and you've been sedated enough that if you didn't have that, you wouldn't be able to maintain your own airway, so you could potentially stop breathing. And there is a requirement that from surgery to the recovery area, that you really have to be able to respond quickly if there's a problem, as we're trying to wake a patient up so that they can maintain their own airway, in case they, not to be graphic, but in case they throw up, they should be able to clear their own secretions or vomit out of their mouth. So visibility and response time for phase one is really important, even if all the rooms are the same. So just like Craig described, if that's kind of cordoned off, you may have an additional nurse there that may be closer to anesthesia, because that's who's really managing those patients. So I know we use a lot of terms. Semi-restricted to have scrubs on. And we do this with the teams a lot, because those terms have evolved and changed over many iterations of the FGI guidelines and of guidelines. And so it's really important that we all are talking about the same thing. So we do a lot of reiteration of that when we're trying to lay the spaces out for the team. I think you asked us earlier how Craig and I work well together. I feel like, one, we have an immense amount of respect for one another. And so we can be completely honest and debate back and forth. And we've done that many times. But I always learn something from those debates, and I always learn how to apply the standard, probably in a more uniform way, just listening to Craig's experience and background. So that's always very helpful for me.
You guys were talking earlier about the size differences, and you're dealing with some limited square footage. So how do you balance efficiency and patient experience when you're dealing with that limited square footage?
You know, with these centers, the smaller they get, honestly, the more challenging sometimes solutions are, especially if your lean flows really start to break down. I've done as small as one OR and 4,200 square feet, and then I've done two ORs and 7,500 square feet. It's very compact, obviously. You have your ratios. Still, you have to maintain a patient care stations and toilets and hand wash sinks. And you still have to have the common chassis, whether you're an NOR or a 2OR, you still have basic pieces. And granted, they're scalable, right? You can't eliminate something just because it's smaller. You still have to have a SPD area. You still have to have locker rooms. So as you balance an efficiency and patient experience, as you look at these things, the offstage design helps. But as you get smaller and smaller, there's less off stage. I mean, you find your communicating corridor between the patient care area and the surgical suite, procedure suite is actually many times the way that there's some crossover of patients coming in from the waiting room when it gets that compact. So it is a challenge, but with the larger centers and you get the luxury of, you know, the five OR facilities, 3 to 5 even, you can really start to manage those flows. They get larger, and then you can really start to manage acoustics, natural lighting. You have more envelope for how you can get lighting into maybe the patient care area, and then also staff to benefit from. You have the service corridors that are kind of tucked away. You manage your visual clutter, the stuff that gives people anxiety. You give that warm environment you get when you're in that patient care environment. People say hospitality many times. That feeling that you're in a really warm environment that's comforting, you're not threatened by. So I think it's how you manage those flows. So yeah, things are kind of chaotic, and that creates anxiety as well. So I think managing the chaos through good planning will also help with the staff and the way they operate, their efficiency, and their ultimate happiness.
I think acoustic separation is important. I think that visual clutter is important, and understanding what the care team sees and also understanding what the patients can see from the room. So really trying to do those visual sight lines, understanding what they see can also help us maximize a smaller space. Making sure that how the patient gets in and how the patient gets out is not so cluttered and small that it's the only thing they remember when they walk out. So maybe you have a larger hallway on one side, and that's how we direct the flow in and out. It's just being creative with what space you have and what you're able to separate and not separate. But I do think what you hear and what you see makes a big difference of whether or not you think your team is competent.
I'll just add on one other thing, because it seems to be such a big discussion in the planning of ASCs. It's the patient care area and this balance between private rooms that might give you some more extended care up to 23 hours if needed. And then the idea of having a super efficient area that's super accessible for like PACU, which just might be cubicle curtains. Every time you introduce a hard wall, even if you're just doing it between stations, and then you put a cubicle curtain at the foot, you're actually increasing the privacy, obviously, but you're also sometimes hindering direct visual access in an area that they might need visual access. You're also potentially hindering sight access. So those individual built walls end up larger. And then if you were to enclose those rooms, which is the ideal scenario, right? If you want to have the maximum privacy, you end up with the sink inside the room. Sometimes people even talk about putting toilets inside the room. You can imagine that type of program as you start to compound it with hand wash sink within the room and toilets and this and that. Your lean plan that you have in the ASC environment starts to creep and not be so lean. And of course, the cost of all of that gets up there too.
But some of the things that I'm starting to see, and this is just a discussion, is that the emergency department split flow model, where non-acute patients are in a recliner or in a space that's not as large versus more acute going back, we're starting to see that creep into places like pre and post areas in ASCs and surgery centers. Because if I'm coming for an eye procedure versus a total hip procedure, that prep and what needs to occur is much less. So really, do you need the same number of rooms? Yeah. And could it be like lower acuity is this section? And really that does, even in a hospital setting, on eye days for my surgical area, we designated 5 rooms for eyes and could run 40 cases out of there because it's such a quick turn. And so that may also be a discussion when you're talking about your service line.
What you're talking about, a lot of what I would say are, you know, let's do this so that we avoid some pain points. So let's keep going on that a little bit. What are some other common operational pain points that good design can address?
I think I'll say the typical nurse one is storage. I think storage and break room space for the nurses or hydration spaces for the nurses are two of those areas that I think are usually underestimated, because everything pre-COVID has always been patient-centric. And now and then post-COVID, storage needs, not requirements. The book didn't keep up with COVID, but the storage needs have increased, because when you have delays in getting certain materials, if you can get them, you order more. So now you've got stuff sitting in the hall. I think we've all been through hospitals over the last 2 years where we've seen pallets of things on the dock. It's just really trying to understand in this post-COVID world, how do we do supply management? Also, equipment. If the equipment's not stored in the room, then it has to be stored somewhere on the operating room platform. So really trying to understand that. And then the pain points of where can you go just to have 5 minutes of time? If that break room or staff room or wherever you are to help a burnout is off your unit, it will not get used. I can emphatically tell you, as a provider and as somebody who does post-occupancy evaluations, they will not get used. It'll just be wasted space. So just trying to be cognizant of, if I have 15 minutes, because remember there's a nursing shortage and there's a staff shortage. Not to say that you don't get a break, but a lot of times it's a fast break. So where can I go for 10 to 20 minutes to just catch my breath, have a drink of water, stay hydrated so that we can continue to be efficient is important. I think those are my two soapboxes that I'll get on.
I'd say that on the removing bottlenecks and diffusing congestion is important. I think that that would strategies like doing procedure wings and not tying up the ORs, doing the quick stuff in a orthopedic center, and then you might even have a little pain suite with a separate area of your patient care stations dedicated close to that suite. And you can manage the flow in those areas and really keep your scheduling on track. So the idea of having an area where you can really have them maximize your coverage and cover for each other, and design it in a manner that allows accommodates that.
So, TJ, what are some staff experience considerations that architects might miss during this process?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about respite and break areas and just understanding some statistics about burnout and trying to incorporate that into design. It may not always be, it's really hard to take a burnout statistic for providers and put that into design, but it is as easy as where's the break room? Does it have natural light? And can I spend 10 minutes to catch my breath? So I think some of those, just rethinking what those staff spaces look like, not only having them available, but what they look like. When we would do POEs, what you would see is it's a locker room, the walls are white, there's no windows, and the lighting's fluorescent. So could there be a little bit of color? Could there be some softer lighting? Could there potentially be a window so that when you walk in, you get that similar to when you walk onto a unit as a patient, you get that moment of, oh, okay, that took my stress down just a little bit. So really using those same principles that we use for patients and how we decrease anxiety is doing the same, I think, for some of the staff, and improve that improves engagement and improves morale. You feel cared about. If you walk into a break room that looks like it was an afterthought and it was a closet, I'm so really trying to be cognizant of that as we design environments, because the staff are in those environments with the patients as well. So,
Include the staff in your design as much as you can, the major stakeholders and the people. You'll get better outcomes, you'll optimize their workflow. And I think that sometimes you actually have to get them to adapt to a different workflow
You
that
do.
you've
That's
actually
true.
seen it work. But also in to have them on board with that decision is huge.
I think that, Craig, that's a great point, because I've been on both sides of the table, and I've said this in other podcasts, but I was the end user for a brand new hospital design. And when a designer or architect asks you your opinion, you feel valued, and you feel a part of
Of
it, and you
course.
feel like they care about you. So it's becoming that trusted partner. We say that a lot in BSA, that we're trusted partners. I think that's a big piece of it, because if Craig asks my opinion about a workflow, that makes me feel valued as a clinical consultant. And if I ask Craig his opinion or I need help and I don't know this information, then I think that builds trust and camaraderie within the team. So I do think that is a really important piece.
Certainly. That makes a lot of sense. Can you walk us through a specific project you guys have completed together? Clearly, you've been working together for a while. What were some of the unique challenges and innovative solutions that you came up with?
I'll just review. We're actually currently working on a 4OR with a future fifth and a two procedure room for a large healthcare system. And we've actually implemented many of the concepts that we've touched on today. But it's a larger size facility. It's got a pretty good number of patient care stations. It's got the combined patient care area, but we've got kind of clusters of what's phase one and phase two and what's prep. Now we've got common support areas that serve both areas. We've got the ability to flow between the two areas, a lot of efficiency factors that you build in. So a lot of the stuff we're talking about, the lean flows have been studied on these things. We really looked at how materials come in. It's on an upper floor. So you actually have to receive the materials, break them down, and then get them to the various parts of the facility where they're going to be used. Equipment comes in. We have to talk about the transfer of patients. So all these different pathways we've talked about with how people flow within the facility and have really been thought about. The patient journey in terms of a very kind of I'll call it a linear journey where you're going from the waiting room into the prep and then off to your procedure and how you progress through the whole thing through discharge, that being kind of a very simple journey for everyone, including staff. And then ultimately you're not going back in the process and your physical movement is not creating a barrier to other flows.
So knowing that as healthcare architects and as a healthcare firm, I think what we do once we have a design or a schematic design laid out, we also talk about the what ifs, right? What if you want to use these rooms as procedure rooms? What if you want to put interventional radiology equipment in here? What if you want to make this part a hospital-based building and this part? So we apply all of these key factors that make this environment as adaptable and as flexible for the next 10 to 20 years as possible.
Sure.
Because stuff will change and really setting up the platform and the surgery center ASC for what they currently want to do, but then also asking the question, even if it doesn't get brought up, if you can do more than one thing in the environment with minimal cost, that tends to make the owner happy and maybe tends to get us some repeat work because they know we're really working hard to make sure their environment's correct.
So you both know from being on in the past with me that I love to talk about the future. So are there any emerging trends in ASC design and operations, any new technology that's changing the environment of these spaces? What do you got for me?
The ORs are getting bigger for the reasons I described earlier. Image guided surgery, robotics, the eye cases and the endoscopies. And you're going to see probably the rooms get a little larger to accommodate the more complexities that will be moving, especially in a multi-specialty environment where they need to accommodate a variety of situations and layouts. We're also seeing on the real-time locating systems, such as sync times, implemented into the operations, and it's pretty cool. And the digital intake and pre-op education and kiosk check-in. And then on the design side, to optimize and really streamline the design phase, we're seeing a lot of standardization, prototyping, and kind of creating a modularity and concepts for how you would roll out already pre-baked solutions that the systems have standardized and agree on, and you're not reinvented every time. There's a lot of good stuff happening really on the design side, on the technology side, really that ultimately impacts the staff and the patient side experience.
But I think the amount of resiliency and how spaces can be used for more than one thing, more than one specialty helps patients and helps with the profitability of the center.
So let's wrap up with a question about advice you would give to healthcare organizations considering an ASC project.
Mine would be simple, would be to know your case mix and what kind of cases you want to do here, because that's really going to affect the size of the cases. It'll affect the length of the cases. It'll help us understand throughput so that we can build appropriate spaces for the patients. I think we talked briefly earlier about a 23-hour observation unit and whether or not you have a need for people that may potentially stay overnight because that changes some of the building requirements. But I really think it's just knowing your case mix and or having some idea of what you might do in this space.
Do not undersize the facility. You don't know how often we have talked to systems and they don't like the 550 bucks a square foot or whatever cost it's going to be to fit out their space. And they want to pull the plan back. A year later, they're calling me trying to figure out how to add another room, additional patient care stations. You just can't, it's really tough to get there if you haven't planned for it. So, plan for growth, master plan for the future. I've never seen one of these centers shrink. They always get bigger. And I hear the same story. And so we hope it's expanding or we're doing a lot more. You know, after our first year, we're doing what we projected for the third year. Plan for soft space, and that's either off areas you can expand to. If you add an OR, you got to add more patient care stations. You have to add more equipment storage, and that's tied to that, more general storage. And then, in addition to the scalable plan that can kind of potentially extrude, have scalable MEP systems. Maybe you can't design it for the future state, but you understand a modular approach of how it might expand and grow to your future needs. Have a strategy for growth in the future.
And just one other thing I would add is the component computers, systems, all these innovative systems need data and need a robust system to support that. So a lot of times the IT infrastructure seems really large, and we always talk about that. But if you really are running some of these innovative designs, you really do need that support. And also asking the staff like how they're using it. And I think listening to the team always helps us make smarter decisions and improve our design. So we always appreciate working with the user team.
Well, this has been one of the more robust conversations I think we've had, and it's been fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you, Brian, for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Brian.
I'd like to thank Terry and Craig for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website at BSA Design. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to check out BSA on social media, including LinkedIn and YouTube. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.